Well, we're going visiting. Visiting to a good friend of ours, a good friend of everyone who calls himself an American reader. Today we're visiting in the home of Mr. George Abe. His home is called Hazelden Farm, located about 2.5 miles east of Brook, Indiana. Ed Mason and Tedford, our engineer, and myself dropped into Mr. Abe's home for a little short visit, and we're going to try to bring to light some of the things that have been interesting to him, and we're sure will be interesting to all of our listeners. We've been sitting here talking with Mr. Abe for 15 or 20 minutes. We've run across some very interesting things, and we're going to let him tell us some of the things that have been important to him, some of the things that have helped to make his life as full as it has been, and to recall some of the incidents that have happened during his lifetime in his writings for various newspapers, and also various other things that he has written. First of all, I think we'd better get a little personal and ask Mr. Abe where he was born.
I was born near here, the county seat of this county, Kentland. And I might as well own up to the date. It's a long time ago. February 9th, 1866. And you cannot, by any system of mathematics, make that out to be less than 74 years old.
Well, that's 74 years just packed full of pleasant memories, isn't
well,
it, Mr. Abe?
Well, yes, I've had a rather busy life. I bet spent my boyhood in Kentland, then I went to Purdue University, and then I found my way to Chicago, and on a newspaper for 10 years, and then I retired at a very early age and began to syndicate my fables in a number of newspapers. I found I had some time on my hands, and I had always been stage struck, or was always very much interested in the theater. So in 1892, I found myself writing plays, and I wrote quite a number before I stopped about 1914.
What were some of them, Mr. Abe?
Well, the first was The Sultan of Sulu, a musical satire. Peggy from Paris. The Shogun, a light opera. The County Chairman. And the most successful of all, the one my meal ticket for a number of years, The College Widow, which is going to be revived this year, by the way. The Fair Coed. Father and the Boys, of William H. Crane. Just Out of College, and also a musical play for Montgomery and Stone called The Old Town. I stopped writing for the stage along about 1914 because I was very much, my health was very bad, and my doctor in Chicago told me that I could not collect royalties while lying horizontal in a cemetery.
And
I retired. I came out here to the country, and I've been living here a great many years. And, of course, after I stopped writing plays, I wrote a great deal for the magazines, and in the 20s, I wrote a number of picture plays for my friend Tom Meehan. One of my principal activities out here for the past 25 years has been building up the Hazelden Country Club. It's a local, a community enterprise with about 175 members in this county and adjoining counties. And it's been a very interesting experience. We have a pretty good country club, have a good clubhouse, We have a dining room. We have everything that a big country club has except the expenses.
That's all
we operate it on a shoestring. Believe it or not, the dues are $20 a year and $5 locker fee. And which seems impossible, but we somehow managed to do it.
Who holds the shoestring?
Well, for a good many years, I was the goat. But they're running in the club themselves now, the boys are.
Do you think it's any harder now for a young man who has aspirations to write for the theater? Is it any harder for him now?
Well, the trouble with the theater is that there are no theaters except in the big towns. And the styles have definitely changed. They are writing different sort of plays. That was shown by the fact that they revived my old county chairman in New York a couple of years ago, and it proved to be just a museum piece. It was old-fashioned. The critics, they spoke kindly of it, but they said it was belonged in the, it was of the past tense. It was a museum piece. And the plays that are being written now are distinctly different from the plays that were popular 30 or 40 years ago. They may not be better, but they're different. And of course, when I was busy around the theater, if we had a play, we would produce it in Chicago and it would run a few weeks and we'd get it into New York and it probably might run a season there, and then it would be good for 2 or 3 years on the road. Well, the trouble is now there is no road. The one-night stands have disappeared. And, of course, you get no revenues now except from the big town.
And so there's a little bit of change that's come
over
the theater.
Yes, there's been quite a change, yes.
I'd like to get back to the theater and some of your plays in particular after your reciting for us a moment ago. And I'd like for you to give us a little of that in just a moment. But first, tell us something about your reporting days.
Well, I started out as reporting the weather.
That's always interesting.
I started out at $12 a week. But they found out the first week that I did know something about the newspaper business, so they raised me to $15. That was in 1890. But by 1892, I had been promoted until I was handling rather important assignments. I reported that year the homestead strike in Pennsylvania, the Sullivan-Corbett fight in New Orleans, and I also went on to New York and covered the news at the National Democratic and Republican headquarters there. Then in 1893, I was given a roving assignment to write some stories about the World's Fair. And they were stories that had no news value, what do you call human interest stories. And after the fair was over, they just kept me writing these stories. And for 7 years, I had a department of my own called the Stories of the Streets and of the Town. That appeared on the editorial page of the Chicago Record. And all of my little books, my first books, appeared first in this column. Artie, Pink Marsh, Doc Horn, Fables and Slang, More Fables. And then by 1900, the fables were being favorably received, and I stopped doing regular newspaper work and began to syndicate. At the same time that Peter Dunne began his Dooley articles, we were contemporary and working for the same man in New York. And for many years, I syndicated my fables, and then I wrote a great deal for the Cosmopolitan, the Saturday Evening Post, and other papers, and, as I say, also got into the theatrical game.
A while ago, Mr. Aiden, we were talking. You told a very interesting little story about the Sullivan fight.
That was one of my first big assignments, and I spilled over on it. I sent in more stuff than I should have sent. But it worked out all right. After the fight was over, I crawled on top of a cab to steal a ride downtown, and a fella crawled up behind me and sat on top of the cab, and he was weeping bitterly. And I asked him if he knew Sullivan, and he said, "Don't you know who I am?" He says, "I'm Steve Brody." Sure enough, it was Steve Brody, the famous fellow who was supposed to jump off of the Brooklyn Bridge. I say supposed because some of the well-informed newspaper men in New York have assured me that, as a matter of fact, Steve didn't jump off of the bridge. But, of course, I don't want to cloud his record after all these years. But I'm telling you what they told me.
Speaking of remorse and about Steve Brody crying on the top of this cab, I think you recited a little verse for us a while ago, something about something
that
was quite remorseful.
In the Salt and the Sultan. Do you want me to recite it?
Yes, why don't you?
All right. I can't recite the whole thing, do you think?
No. Well, just as you did a while ago, I think we can take all that.
Well, this is from the Sultan of Sulu, and it's just as true now as it was 38 years ago. The cocktail is a pleasant drink. It's mild and harmless, I don't think. When you've had one, you call for two, and then you don't care what you do. Last night, I hoisted 23 of those arrangements into me. My wealth increased. I swelled with pride. I was pickled, primed, and ossified. But R-E-M-O-R-S-E. The water wagon is the place for me. Last night at 12, I felt immense. Today, I feel like 30 cents. My eyes are blear, my copper's hot. I'd like to eat, but I cannot. It is no time for mirth and laughter, the cold gray dawn of the morning after.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Aid. Did you have some poems of remorse? Did you have some others that you had written? That was the one we had reference to.
Yes. That was a contributing phrase to the American language, the
yes,
cold gray dawn.
The cold gray dawn of the morning after, I think. Probably I invented that phrase.
Suppose you give for us a few lines from another one of your shows. I know there's so many of them, and I've read a good many of them, but I can't recite them off.
Well, it's a funny thing. For many years, I have had a trademark. Many years ago, I put on a fable. A moral. I didn't think it was very original or very funny, but it seems that Frank Daniels, the old-time light opera comedian, thought it was pretty good because he borrowed it and used it in one of his plays. And I was sitting out in front one night, and I heard him speak this line on the stage. And much to my surprise, people laughed at it. And I said, "Well, that's mine. And if it's funny, why, I will use that hereafter every time I write in an autograph album." I'm always at a loss to think of what to write. And this is brief. And so this is what I have written in every autograph album for many years. And you can take it or leave it. I don't know whether it's funny or not. But the people in the audience that night thought it was funny. Here it is. Early to bed and early to rise, And you will meet very few prominent people. Well, it got a laugh out of these boys.
I guess it did. Something that is pretty true.
Yeah.
When we walked into your office out there a moment ago, I noticed a life-size picture of Will Rogers.
Yeah, I know him pretty well. I've met him occasionally, and he sent this to me on my birthday, just the year that he was lost.
Mm-hmm. You, in your writings and your various travels from Chicago to New York and probably all over this country, and I don't know where else, you must have run into a lot of interesting people.
The most interesting man I ever met, most interesting individual, I'd say it, was that James Whitcomb Riley. There was nobody else that was like him. He was different from anybody else. He was the most amusing storyteller, the most original character, and the most captivating companion that I ever met.
He was also a Hoosier, too.
Oh, yes, he was. They say he was the typical Hoosier. I say he's not the typical Hoosier, because if all the Hoosiers were like him, why, Indiana would be paradise.